You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm delighted to say that my guest in the studio today is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. My guest is Danny Dorling. Hello.
Hi there.
You have a new book out, sir. It has a brick on the cover. It made me think, reading All That Is Solid, The Great Housing Disaster, that anyone who is reading this alertly might want to think about having bricks in their hands. Is that fair?
Yes, it did get a bit longer than it was supposed to be, so it is quite a thick book, yeah.
But also the idea that there's a lot in this book. There's a lot in this book that made me angry and a lot that I found really upsetting. Does that mean I've become British at last, that I'm upset about housing?
Yes, you're beginning to become more British, but it helps that you're in London. I began writing that book in Sheffield, and it wasn't that angry a book. And moving to Oxford and then trying to find housing in Oxford helped make it a bit more angry. So if you weren't based in London, you may not have become such a Brit quite so quickly.
The Great When does feature a lot in this, and there's a line in here that I thought was particularly telling and particularly merciless, which is, you describe London as the former capital of an old imperial empire that now functions more like an offshore tax haven.
Yes.
It's pretty damning and sleazy sounding.
It's fairly damning, but there are international definitions of what a tax haven is. And when you look at them, the UK, and in particular London, would actually qualify along with the Cayman Islands and various other places. So we have got ourselves into a position that is particularly embarrassing, and we need to be embarrassed about it. And we're quite good at being embarrassed in Britain, as long as we learn what it is we need to be embarrassed about. And becoming a tax haven really isn't something to be particularly proud of.
And so there's the illusion of growth and the illusion of the property market booming.
Yeah.
And also, you point out perhaps that there's a conspiracy of silence. You discuss Ireland and the housing crash there and the economic crash and the fact that Irish people said, well, we didn't really know anything about that. We didn't read anything about it in the papers. Yeah. Is there the sense that we don't want to know too much about what happened in Spain or Portugal or Ireland might frighten us?
And in Ireland before the crash, there was very little warning of what was possible. Very little material from the doubters was published. And people have analysed this in Ireland as things, because, of course, in Ireland, now that house prices have halved, or more than halved in some cases, you have a very angry population. And they've gone back and looked at their kind of how lethargic the media was beforehand. But the amazing thing in Britain is how little reporting we get about Ireland. It's not exactly far away. How little reporting we get about the USA and what's happened to the housing market there. And it's partly linked to the stake that people in Britain, particularly people in London, particularly people over 40, have in housing, in that they really do need this market to, as far as they think, they need this market to carry on to survive. And if it keeps on bubbling upwards, they feel they're getting richer, and so they don't want to knock it. But young Londoners are the opposite. They're getting irate. People in their 30s and under in London are beginning to work out, not only have they been handed a very large student debt, which is growing, but now they're being put into a situation where they're having to pay higher and higher rent. It's going up by 10% a year. And when they start to form families and want to buy their starter homes, they can't buy them because some landlord's gone and bought the starter homes. And so you're getting this split in London between an older group who appear to be doing well and the younger group who are getting very, very angry about the situation.
Do you think the worm has turned? I mean, I wondered how you thought this book would be received, because obviously as a scholar who touches on a lot of issues of inequality, you know that the usual suspects will find it easier to say, well, he's got a political agenda, yeah, or it is the sort of thing an academic would say, especially someone we think be vaguely left-wing.
Yeah.
But you are taking on a lot of powerful people in this book. So did you think you'd be covered with as much mud as people could manage, or...?
Some mud. I think the worm is turning in some ways, but there's also some great ignorance in some ways. So earlier today I was discussing with somebody who represents Landlords Association, who is trying to say that because they're only making 6% profit a year, they were doing very badly. And it just showed how they just didn't have a grasp about how the average person in Britain has become poorer. the fact that they're complaining that they're not making a 15 or 20% profit a year, but only a 6% profit. So I think there's more still a sense of just enormous ignorance going on. But the second thing to say is that this housing crisis and the cost of living crisis has now stretched into a large proportion of the top 10% of people in Britain are affected. Now, you can normally get away with having wide and high inequality as long as the top 10 and 20% are being looked after. But once you get into a situation where the majority of the top 10% are seeing their take-home pay fall and their housing costs rise, it's really hard to fool the top 10% as well as the rest of the population. And in that sense, I think the worm is turning in that such a tiny proportion of people are now doing well that most people are beginning to not blame themselves for the fact that they're not well off. And they're beginning to realise that you can't all fit into the 1%.
And this top 10 who are starting to feel the squeeze, they are the people tactfully referred to as the squeezed middle,
yes,
are they not?
They are referred to as the squeezed middle.
From the perspective of people who are well-to-do, they see them as...
Yes. Well, I mean, the amazing thing you hear from people who are well-to-do is they see mortgages as something that poor people take out, which is quite a shock to suddenly realise that that's their way of thinking.
You talk a lot in the book about cash buyers for things. Of course, that always does sound to me like brown envelopes full of ill-gotten gains, but it's not merely that, is it?
It's just for people with enough wealth that you wouldn't take out a loan to buy something. And just as most middle class, or by middle I actually mean medium in the middle of the distribution, people wouldn't buy goods on loans. You'd save up and, you know, buy yourself a radio or a bike or something
the
else.
The higher purchase method.
Yep. For the rich, they don't buy housing with debt, and a lot of landlords are now buying houses using the cash that they're getting from the rents that they're charging. So there's a group of landlords who are getting out of having to borrow money to increase their housing empires.
The old rentier society writ large. Mm. I thought it quite interesting. You mentioned at one point in the book about a colleague who jokes about, quite bitterly or unsettlingly, about putting up an electric fence around their home to let the nanny in and keep the rabble out. That kind of apocalyptic thinking obviously shows that, as you say, higher up the income distribution, people are thinking about and worrying about how bad things can get.
Well, some people are. I mean, this is a particularly, you know, somebody from the more enlightened part of the 1%, but certainly from the 1%. Not thinking that things are going to change much and not thinking there's going to be a redistribution. But realising that for the rest of society, by which this particular colleague meant the 99%, things are going to get worse for all of them. And then the question was, well, how are you going to carry on? And in a sense, putting up barriers, it wouldn't be an electric fence, but you would make sure that you didn't house the poor near their house. And there are people, I think, thinking of a model of how could Britain become even more unequal, rather than, and thinking that anything else isn't feasible. And that's fairly sad, so I thought I'd report it.
Yeah. I think there must be, even for people who are not quite so high up the ladder, the sense of anxiety about housing, again talking about homeowners over 40, as you say, in the southeast of England, guilt, worry that so much money is being spent for so little, anxiety about the fact that we know things are different in other places.
Yeah. Well, over 40 now, between 40 and 50 now means first-time buyer. So these are people who've just bought,
just scrambled into a terrible flat
market, and don't sleep at night because they're worried about a 0.5% interest rate rise, which they couldn't cope. And these are some of the best paid people in the country. And they're relying on it going up a little bit more, so that another cohort, 2 or 3 years on, will be those most at risk. And the fact that this kind of fear and anxiety and worry is gripping people who are some of the best rewarded in the UK, I mean, that really is new. And housing is almost the only way in which people very near the top of the income structure are experiencing some of the kind of suffering that other people experience from problems with schools or problems with employment or problems just buying food. These are not worries for people in the top tenth, but housing is a worry for people in the top tenth, and it's one of the few ways in which the rich can empathise with the problems of the majority of society.
I was surprised that the review of this book in the Evening Standard, when you told me by email yesterday that the Standard was reviewing the book, I wondered whether of course, I see it as a paper for commuters, but also for London and the city, and it needs to boost things. It seemed like a positive review. It does strike me then that maybe more people are open to this message than I thought.
There is a worm turning. The Standard has actually been running a poverty campaign in London. Standard is a fairly extreme newspaper, but it's quite incredible some things going on in the Standard. But also the particular reporter, you could get a sense of their life coming out in that review, which shows how this works. But as well as the Standard, the Financial Times now has begun to look at the state of things in Britain and see it as unsustainable. And that's the FT. I mean, if 10 years ago I'd sort of said the FT would be saying we had a major problem with greed and wealth at the top, you know, it would be hard to have imagined. But so we are seeing a shift. The shift is happening gradually. So we acclimatise it, so we don't celebrate part of it, and we still have huge problems. But we are seeing a movement in attitudes and opinions, and in some ways, it's similar to the kind of shift that happened in the late 20s and much of the 1930s in Britain, when those at the top of society went from being incredibly arrogant and not caring about people in the bottom to becoming much better informed and much less greedy. So salaries at the top in the 30s stopped rising, partly because people began to realise in an era of mass unemployment, asking for more and behaving like they behaved in the early 20s really had stopped becoming acceptable.
And was no longer in their own interest, perhaps?
Wasn't in their own interest, no. But the big difference, of course, then is that there'd just been a revolution in Russia. So they had something to really concentrate their minds about what happens if you do treat the poor badly.
It focused their minds. Yeah. Here's something that our reviewer, that you haven't seen the review yet, has said in his review. Back in the early 1990s, when he first began to publish, this is speaking of you, there was a feeling in geography that Danny Dorling was somewhat out of step with the approaches fashionable at the time. Back then, too many of us spent too long crafting ever more elaborate but ultimately disengaged cultural theory, little of which endured. Geography's failure to contribute to the big debates in ways that it could and should is a continuing concern. Dorling's belief in evidence, engagement, and impact is helping to address that public lacuna. Now, of course, that's a very nice thing of him to say, but does that jive with what your experience was when in 1992 you wrote in The Observer, houses are for living in, not for profit, with some colleagues, essentially, you know, one of the things that you're saying now. Do you feel like you were a very young academic at the time, you just got your doctorate, but do you feel like geography is moving around to your approach?
Parts of it slowly. Also, back then, I still find writing quite difficult. And back then, I found it incredibly difficult. I was good at maths. I could draw computer maps. But I couldn't have been a cultural geographer because my ability to spell very long words just isn't good enough. The other thing, to be fair to what cultural geographers were writing then, is that they were almost writing in code about what was wrong in society. And I think they were partly writing in code because they were scared of being labelled as radicals. So they, you know, if you decode, and now I've got old enough I can actually read and that I can skim read a paper that an undergraduate can never understand, and I could see what the three-line summary of the entire paper is. And it's basically saying everything is wrong and it's all terrible and we need a new world. But if you look back at that time, coming out of the Cold War and so on, being on the left was seen as being odd. Marxism was on the way down from the 1970s.
The end of history, apparently.
Oh, yes, and the rise of all of that on the right. And the left in academia, in a way, retreated into more obscure language.
So they couldn't be caught?
They were somehow scared of being caught, and also they might have been scared because the students were becoming more right-wing. So maybe they didn't want the undergraduates to actually understand, you know, or at least the undergraduates had to put some effort in before they could understand what their teachers were actually thinking. I'm being a bit unfair, but I'm trying to be charitable to it. And it's more complicated than that. I mean, they were also making intellectual jumps and leaps at the time, and moving between disciplines in a way that we hadn't before. Because if you look at geography, one of the interesting things about geography, this is a discipline which was largely created in England to train young men to run an empire. To draw a map, understand the mountains and rivers, know how crops form, all those kind of things. Once the colonies gained independence in the 1960s, the actual rationale need to produce geographers decreased, and its sister discipline is anthropology, and it shrunk dramatically. Geography was searching around for a new home or a new reason to exist, and part of what was going on at the time was trying to think of new aspects for geographers to be interested in. The nice thing that's happened now to geography is that, almost partly by accident, it stumbled across two of the main issues of the day. One is climate change, which is what almost a majority of physical geographers are now involved in looking at, and suddenly they've become incredibly relevant. And the other is poverty and inequality, which is largely a geographical issue because it's most clearly seen when you look at differences between countries and differences within countries and differences within cities. So geography has found a new purpose or reason to exist. But back then, from the 80s to the 90s, it was kind of stumbling around. And it could have largely disappeared as a discipline. In much of the world, it has disappeared.
You mention in this book that the genesis of the book is one. It was suggested by Tom Penn at Penguin, your editor, and you also mentioned that Anthony Harwood, your agent, helped quite a lot. We know that you've written about these issues before, but I thought it was an incredibly generous thing of an academic, or indeed any author, to say, not I thought up this idea myself, these are my ideas. Of course, nobody shapes anything. They come straight from my giant forehead onto the page. It's a very generous humble way to describe how this book came
about. It's not so much that. It's partly being honest and partly trying to explain that I honestly didn't have an axe to grind at the beginning of this. They suggested it, and I wasn't still too sure, because you always have your own ideas you want to do. But I tend to find that when people suggest you do something, they've often got a point. And also, I had a kind of guilt about housing because it was the beginning of my career. My first research jobs were in housing. The Roundtree Foundation funded my first fellowship. I was funded to look at homelessness, and then that was overtaken by a small housing crash and negative equity. So I'd done lots of my first academic papers, which, of course, they're the ones that are really hard to do, that take you 3 or 4 months to write, and then they're turned down. All that first part of my career had been looking at housing. And I'd only written things which were largely obscure on it. And I also thought, we're coming round again to another kind of crisis. I've been here before, so you can write with a little bit more reflection on it. But without their encouragement, and also without them, I mean, they did take the first draft, move it around entirely, cut a large chapter. And so part of the reason why the book is a brick is because when somebody moves it all around and says they want you to write more parts, you end up adding more than you take away. But hopefully that helps.
It's also obviously a very topical book. No one can write a book that's not of its time. But you say quite clearly at many points, you know, as I'm writing this at the end of 2013, do you worry that it will be overtaken by events, or maybe good events, but possibly awful events?
I mean, somebody's claimed that there's been a book written about housing every year for the last 40 years, I think. I mean, as I was finishing the first draft of this, house prices were actually falling in parts of London. And then, I mean, this was only summer 2013. Government policy from the budget of 2013 onwards began to concentrate more on housing than anything else. So housing always changes, and it's a kind of very random fluctuation to do with prices. But I happen to be drafting and redrafting and editing this book at a time of more change in housing than before. And I think that was good, because it got me more interested in it, because clearly this was an unstable situation. Why are you getting new government policy after new government policy? Why is the Prime Minister bringing Help to Buy, which was supposed to start in January of this year? He suddenly brought it forward to the week before his election speech. And it was partly because they were scared that the houses' prices were going to fall.
And then the sky really will fall for a lot of people, won't it?
If they fall for a lot of people's... A very large number of people in England are basing their hopes and are trying to lay their fears on the idea that their property will look after them.
It's my pension.
Yeah.
How many times have you heard that?
Yeah, it's my pension, or it's my children's futures. It's their deposits. And people often see the sort of sum of their life's work as being wrapped up in the positive equity that is in their house. So politically, this government, this coalition, really can't cope with a price fall, even though it would be so desirable for so many people. And in a sense, if all prices fall a bit gently, you know, it really doesn't hurt those at the top that much, and those are the top of those which we've got most.
Your publication rate in terms of monographs is not to be sniffed at. 3 monographs in 2013. You have a new chair at Oxford. You are busy in the media a lot, public engagement, and policymakers want to talk to you a lot. How do you find the time to do all of this?
Well, sometimes I don't. So it's probably too many monographs in that kind of period. And the reason for so many recently has been just people started to ask. I mean, and for the first 20 years of being an academic, it was quite hard getting a book published. You know, you send off proposals and they're rejected and so on. So when publishers actually start to ask, and then when they pester you to write a book, it's quite hard to say no. A lot of the material in those recent books has been things that I worked on in earlier years that I could simply bring up to date. So that was one way of doing it. And the other is just a lot of help from people. If the acknowledgements lists are actually genuine acknowledgements to people who have gone through and corrected drafts for me and other things. And I became quite good, partly because I found writing so difficult at the start of my career. One thing I learned is how to ask people for help and not be embarrassed to say, would you mind reading through this manuscript and helping correct it? And asking people early enough so there's lots of time to do that. And that actually makes it possible to produce things quite quickly. But I'm going to slow down a bit now.
Were you surprised at the offer from Oxford? And did you consider whether or not to take it? I mean, who wouldn't want to work at Oxford, I suppose?
Well, a boy who grew up in Oxford might not want to work in Oxford. Because if you grow up in the town, particularly in the 1980s, there's quite a lot of antagonism between the town and the university. I laughed when they phoned up the first time. I thought it wasn't. I honestly thought they were asking me because they wanted to increase the field to make it look more respectable for somebody else who was going to get the job. That honestly. Because I'm on the edge of geography and what I do isn't the mainstream of human geography, isn't the stuff which is sort of most highly rated, say, in some of the top geography journals. Because I'm this person who's seen as doing more policy and more direct things than is usual, I didn't expect to end up there. And then the second time they asked me, I said I'd go to interview, and I still didn't actually expect. So it was quite a surprise to end up going back there. But quite nice. It's been interesting and a much nicer experience than I thought it would be, because I had a series of prejudices about Oxford University, which a lot of children who grow up in Oxford have, and it turned out to be not quite as stuffy as I thought it would be. You've got to remember, in the 1980s, Oxford still had those men with bowler hats that stopped you going in. I never went into a college. And it was a place where...
You lived there till you were 18, till you went to Newcastle, but you'd never been in a college.
I'd never been in a college, and also the undergraduates were very, very upper-class young men who used to get very drunk and were obnoxious, and you'd see them smashing wine glasses in the main square.
The Bullingdon Club, of whom we have heard so much.
Yes, they were. Well, if you work out my age, I'll have been 16 or 17 at the time of the most famous recent members of the Bullingdon Club were smashing that restaurant. And the kind of pubs and clubs I went to were next door to the ones that they did, but Town and Gown went and drank in different places.
Yeah. You've written a lot for the media over the years, and I wondered whether... Of course, one wants to put ideas across, and any opportunity is a good one. People, as they proceed in their careers, especially if you want to be perhaps taken seriously by policymakers, maybe will think twice about some of the places they speak or they write. You addressed Occupy London. You've written for Socialist Worker, which I suppose many academics on the left would see as being beyond the pale mm-hmm. in terms of who's being addressed.
Yes.
Would you say that's fair? Does that mean you're a member of the Socialist Workers' Party?
I'm not a member of any party. I'm not disciplined enough to be a member of a party. I've written in the Times. I've written for Murdoch Papers. I've actually written in the Daily Mail. So I tend not to self-censure. I try not to self-censure over things I do. There's certain things I won't do. I'll never go onto a platform with somebody from the BNP, for instance. I won't take money from tobacco companies. You know, I've got a series of lines which are hardly radical. So I just don't do this willy-nilly. I have some idea of what I'll do. And the Socialist Worker Party, of course, got themselves into absolute terrible trouble in the last, is it now, 12 months? And so I haven't actually written for them within that last 12 months, and I hope they sort themselves out a bit. But most of what I've written has, you have to admit, it has been in The Guardian when it gets asked. And the most interesting thing about writing in The Guardian is if you want your academic colleagues to know what you're researching on, if you write in The Guardian, they read it. If you write it in an academic journal, they're incredibly unlikely to, because there are so many academic journals.
We find it also with our publication, of course. Book review in our pages will be seen by people across the sector rather than just in the discipline.
So and getting reviewed in your publication is seen as an achievement as well. But there are lots of books and there's only so many you can review. So I think you've only reviewed two of mine, and I've done quite a few.
We can't keep up. Now, when we were corresponding last week, you were flying off to the United Nations meeting on inequality, and you said with actual policy recommendations. How did you get mixed up with that lot, and what went on?
I got mixed up because they'd actually picked papers I'd written about 4 or 5 years ago and put in graphs and other things I'd done into their draft report. So that turned out why they'd invited me. That was a very interesting meeting. I'd never been in a UN building before. And the interesting thing was there were people, literally, from each part of the world around the table, although they were all male. I mean, that was the other thing to say. And it was a very robust meeting. The draft report the UN have produced is brilliant. Whether that gets through to the final World Economic Social Survey report that's going to be published in June, it'll be watered down a bit. But the fact that the UN is addressing economic inequality and seeing it as a problem for sustainability of the planet, really is, it's quite a jump for the UN. It's a faster move towards things which are there's less consensus on than the UN normally does. But the UN sees economic inequality much more as a global problem, and the super rich are something that no one country on its own can deal with. But whether what I talked about last week ends up being quite as explicit as that. But part of what's being discovered is that countries with higher economic inequality, such as the USA, everybody pollutes more. The poor pollute more, the rich pollute more. The amount of carbon that's being released per decile population is far higher than the countries like Germany, where the rich in Germany are less rich and they're more careful about turning the thermostat down. The poor in Germany are less poor.
They don't have to live as far away. They're not obliged to have a car in order to get to their work.
Yep, and this results in people polluting twice as much in the unequal rich countries as in the rich ones. So if you're worrying about climate change, you need to worry about economic inequality. And the old idea, which is that if the rich have all the money, they'll look after it carefully, just doesn't stand out with the data. They end up not worrying about the heating. You end up with the heating on in the house and the windows open, because if you're in a £2 or 3 million house in Kensington, the heating bill doesn't matter.
It's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
So do you feel hopeful after you go to meetings like this? I mean, I know it depends on what meeting it is, not just merely going to a big building with people from around the world around the table. But do you ever come back from various policy meetings thinking, why the hell did I do that? The World Health Organization, this was a waste of time?
The only thing I ever come back feeling sad from are political party conferences. I've done Green, Labour, Liberal and Conservative now, and they're the only things I come back sad from, partly because in the lobbies of these conferences they have all these business interest groups who have their own little stands, so you're walking past all these suits all the time, and partly because the debate on the floors are often so tame. But they're the only things I go to where odds on I'll be more depressed than when I turned up are those. And that's a sort of sad thing to say, but
on the other hand, you've mentioned to me also that politicians and policymakers, you can learn things from them. Some of them are trying to do a good job.
Oh no, I'd agree. And it's not just some of them doing a good job. The majority of them are well-meaning and actually working very long hours and putting themselves out to try to make the world a better place. It's just something about party...
This is politicians we're talking about.
Politicians, but when you put them all together in a party conference, for some reason the collective result of a lot of politicians in one building, you know, several hundred, tends to be to produce a sense of you can't do anything, or any suggestion which is even slightly away from the normal is seen as impossible and far too radical. And I don't know why it is, but...
reversion to the mean, of meanness.
Yeah, aversion to the mean and normality. And it may be the corporate sponsorship that's going on in the meetings. These fringe meetings I go to are always sponsored by, I won't name any of the companies, but they're companies with money and an interest. But that is the, you know, I go to lots, I may go to 100 different things a year. On the other side, which is depressing with the cuts, I went to lots of meetings in 2009 and 10 locally in South Yorkshire about groups that were being cut down or protest meetings to try to, and that was a fairly depressing time.
There are a lot of words in this book that are not necessarily disinterested and academic. If I didn't know better, I'd suggest you'd been raised a Methodist. You say, I believe that London will become soulless and cruel as a result if
the way it's going,
continue, the way it's going, and ultimately speculation in houses is wrong. Yeah. Those are angry things, but that's the language of justice and emotion and so on. That's not academic language.
Oh, well, no. I mean, if you take the soulless one, the one I'm thinking is about how people treat homeless people.
Yeah.
And when homelessness, when I was a child, homelessness was largely elderly men. And then when young homelessness began, people were shocked. We now know from academic research in the States where they've scanned people's brains that people now don't recognise a homeless person as different from a pile of litter. So I sometimes don't make it very clear. When I say something like London becoming soulless, I actually mean it technically, almost medically.
Yeah.
And the speculation one, that it's a problem with how I write, because people often say I'm angry, and often things have been toned down. The speculation is it just isn't possible to endlessly speculate on this thing. It's not necessarily whether it's a bad thing or a good thing. If you're going to see London house prices, which I think London's just taken over from Tokyo as the most expensive city in the world.
Hurrah for London. Yeah, that's great.
The only way it can carry on is if the rest of the world's super rich, of which there aren't many, all themselves buy a property in London. If we have more immigration of incredibly affluent people, and to carry on for, say, another 10 or 20 years and have a similar house price rise to the one we've come to, I haven't put it in the book because it was too ridiculous, but in 20 years' time, if these prices are going to carry on rising at this rate, you have to have aliens arrive in spaceships from another planet with bars of platinum to buy. This is the only physical way I can work out that they can continue. So it's not a Methodist emotive thing. It is just a logical. I'll give you another example.
Hmm.
Life expectancy recently in Westminster and Kensington and Chelsea has been rising rapidly. And in a few years recently, it rose by more than 1 year within a year. So, you know, the life expectancy for women would go up from, say, 94 to 96. Now, the only way that's sustainable is if people in Kensington and Chelsea become like the gods in Mount Olympus and never die.
Or the ethnic cleansing that Boris Johnson said he would prevent.
He would prevent.
But, happening.
Yeah, it's partly because it's happening. But because human beings cannot live to 200 years, this is going to come to an end. And the other thing it tells you is that we are living through really peculiar times when you get that kind of change. Or similarly, London house prices going up by more than average London wages in 1 year. That's a sign that something's strange and wrong, and it can't carry on for very long, because you have a population with almost no money having to pay for housing which is worth, you know, not five or six times their salary, but 15, 20, 25 times their annual salary. So it isn't going to happen. And it's, you know, there are things I get very angry about, but something about the way I write makes people think I'm angry about other things which I think are wrong or bad.
Maybe it's just that we read this and think someone is actually saying what the impact of this is, and is not couching academic discussion in safely neutral words. But, I mean, this is a very difficult book to read in that sense, but not because you're a frothing at the mouth street corner ranter, but just because the truths that are in here, it seems to me, are so harsh and, to a reader like me, incontrovertible. So
it is stark at the moment, and it really is pretty bad.
What about revolution then? You say no paternalistic patron ever willingly hands over the keys. When things have got better, it's because they've been made better. When we tolerate what is bad, what we get is bad.
Yes.
So should we be on the barricades?
We need to realise that when we have had change for the better, it hasn't been easy to win. The fastest way in which a country becomes more equal is losing a war. That's why Japan has become such an equal country, or Germany, or so on. For this country, it took not losing a war, but losing its position as the richest country in the world, and that helped, because we simply couldn't afford the inequality we had, say, in 1913 anymore. And then running a war was very expensive in the First World War, and that helped. If you look back at the 1970s, is where different countries went in different directions. Whatever they did in France, or whatever they did in Sweden, they put more effort in enough to avoid their countries going the way that we did and the USA did. So just being a bit nice, just being a bit caring, isn't enough to counter the opposite forces, which are for a small number of greedy people to try to get themselves more and more. So you do need a sustained degree of anger and disgust at what's happening. And the hard thing is you need that, and at the same time you need optimism, because it's very hard to keep things going if you're just angry and annoyed. So you need optimism, you need to be able to see forward and to see it's possible to have a world in which your children and their children are living a better life than you. And one of the nicest ways to do this is just to jump forward 100 years. And if you say to people, what kind of education system would you like there to be in 100 years? Would you like it to be? You think now, and that stops people defending what we currently have. And it helps make people realise just how ridiculous part of what we currently have in educational divides is, or in the kind of work we expect people to do. And that helps the optimism, is jumping forward and then saying, what would you like to have? And if you think it's hard to be optimistic, you can go back 100 years and look at all the achievements we've had. And you'd have to be utopian 100 years ago to say that, you know, we'd have a position in which, say, the majority of university graduates are female. You know, somebody would have said you were mad if you said that 100 years ago. So lots and lots of things do get dramatically better, but they didn't get dramatically better without somebody being quite determined to try to make them better.
You know the stats better than most. But you talk about having studied the 1980s crash as part of your doctoral research. Are you hopeful? Are you hopeful that council tax bans will be increased, that a land tax may be imposed, that the right to sell as well as the right to buy will be imposed, that maybe Labour will go for a 1% mansion tax and not back out of it? Are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful in the medium term, in that I don't think we're going to head towards a Blade Runner society, or the step towards that become like Singapore, which is about the only model. If you want, I mean, we are so extreme in Britain that there's only one, apart from the
USA,
there's only one place to go, which is Singapore, which is you have guest workers in a new pregnancy test them every 3 months, which is what Singapore now does. Now, that is unlikely, and given that's unlikely, I'm hopeful. What I worry about is whether some of these things take 30 years rather than 10 years to occur. A land tax is actually supported by people on the right as well. It's not that great a claim to want, and I'm not even suggesting we go for it straight away. I'm just saying do what they did in Wales. In Wales, they've added a council tax band above. They've left us all the letters up to Z on the council tax banding. So it's not that hard to put in council, and it only affects people in the top band. So these things are not that hard to do. The worry is how long it takes. I'll give you another example. There was a movement for comprehensive schools for a long time in the 1920s and 30s. The first comprehensive was in the Isle of Wight in 1945, but it took all the time from 1945 through to about 1977 before you had 70-80% of people going to the same school as everybody else. So things can take a long time before they are accepted. And of course now we have a battle against, you know, people are wanting to divide children up again into separate schools and not have them all sharing the same playgrounds. So you can have periods in which you go into reverse, but we tend to underestimate just how much we've achieved and what we've changed over time, and we don't often think that success is possible. And one other problem is we often look at the successes of the past and then just want to replicate them. So I'm not in favour of mass council house building now. I mean, that was a solution for a particular time. And I think one problem on the left is they and we, because I'm on the left, often hark back to the 70s and just say, couldn't we do more of what we did in the 70s? But if you'd done the same thing in the 70s, you'd have harked back to the 1930s and tried to implement 1930s solutions.
Right.
You have to be more imaginative, and you have to realise that time's moved on and people want something else and something better. But better doesn't have to mean more exclusive, more unequal. They just want to feel safe, stable, and not being cheated. And it's how do you arrange things so that people think they're getting their fair share and being well treated, other than telling people you've all got to look after yourself, try and make as much money as you can, and you might be okay in old age, and don't worry about the other people you're making money from. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster.
Danny Dorling, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.